Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
Driving from SeaTac Airport to California, Nevada, and back is, for a West Coast U.S. American, a road trip. For a European, it's like driving from London to Beirut. Think of that for a moment. John Tanner not only thought about that, but did it and wrote about it in the book How to Make an America, in which he writes, "The West is wild at heart. Flood and fire and drought and blizzard, quakes and eruptions ready to roll, bears, rattlers, mountain lions, cities stretchered on desert floors, tubed and wired to life support. And then there are the human killers, 21st century gunslingers who claim more notches in a single strike than Wyatt Earp could manage in a lifetime." John Tanner's verses appeared in various magazines, in the anthology The Lie of the Land, and in a collection of his work pieces. From the Edge, a prose poetry memoir of growing up sort of in South Wales, is due out shortly, if not already. And John is also the author of Landscapes of Language, a study of the writer Richard Brautigan. A journalist and publishing exec before returning to the university to earn a PhD in English Lit from Bangor University and become a part-time tutor there as part of his story, as is the occasional penchant for breaking the speed limit. John, welcome.
Thank you. Very nice. Thank you. Welcome.
It's a great story of how this book came to be. So please tell folks just exactly how it happened.
It's partly or even significantly down to yourself, because you invited me to speak at one of the Cascadia Poetry Festivals, one that had been dedicated or strongly featured Richard Brautigan, and was held in the city where he was born. And I thought, well, I'm going to have a lot of time, or at least I can make a lot of time after the conference. So I flew into Seattle, went to the conference, did my bit, and then I picked up a car from SeaTac Airport and drove, 2,700 odd miles through a lot of the western states, and did it in 7 days. So it was quite a trip, really. And I'd written quite a lot of poetry with an American focus. I've spent a lot of time in America, sometimes on business, mostly pleasure, and an awful lot of that time was spent in the western states. So I already had poems that could fit around a piece about the road trip and the developed themes. Or rather, I didn't really know that I developed themes until I started reading back to myself some of the early poetry and thought, yeah, there are actually themes here. So that's how it came about.
In England, 100 years is nothing and 100 miles is enormous. And it's the opposite in the United States, especially the West.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hear... if somebody commutes or somebody goes on holiday, I don't know, 100 miles away, that's a big trip. But there's suburbs of Los Angeles that are almost 100 miles away.
It's going to work.
Or effectively suburbs of Los Angeles.
Yeah. You write in the introduction to the book, "The American West, a place so mythologized and mediated that preconceived images condition our experience of the real thing." Tell us what myths you associate with the U.S. American West.
Well, when I was growing up, and I never realized this until later, a lot of our entertainment was from America. The films that we saw were typically Wild West films. Once we had a TV, which by British standards, never mind American standards, was quite late, a lot of the stuff that we'd watch there would be American series, and many of those would be westerns, Gunsmoke, The Lone Ranger, The Range Rider, and so on. And so, without really realizing it, I was growing up through mediated experiences as much with American influences, or almost as much with American influences, as I was with local, particularly local ones, and more broadly, British ones. And I suppose it was Western mythology as much as anything that was powerful. I mean, I never thought of it as a mythology at the time. I thought, well, these things must be true, surely. But of course, a lot of it wasn't. I remember being shocked to read, what was it? Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That's the one. And after that, I wanted to go back to being a kid again, playing cowboys and Indians, and being an Indian instead, but it was a bit late for that. But yes, also urban mythologies, which create a picture of Los Angeles and New York that you're always going to have in your mind superimposed upon anything you see in the real Los Angeles or the real New York. And these sort of movies in your head become what the place is. And I'm sure that's actually true for many or most Americans, because certainly the main market for Western films and penny dreadful novels that used to be produced about outlaws in the early 20th century, I think I'm right, or even earlier, I think, they were aimed predominantly where the population was, which was in the East, at an urban Eastern audience, as I understand it. So that would have been the image of the West for most Americans at the time.
I was working at the Muckleshoot Tribal College, and a co-worker, Janet, said, when they win, it's a great victory. When we win, it's a massacre. One of the characters that comes up in the book is Clint Eastwood. So there's a poem about him. Clint Eastwood rides into town. Would you like to read that poem and talk about where do you begin with Clint Eastwood? Where do you begin with a character like that? Some people would say, you know, if they're highly driven by politics, say, here's an actor who lost a debate to an empty chair.
I think he embodies some of the most potent myths associated with the West, about the Lone Rider, the stranger who comes into town, sets story in action, resolves or begins or both people's problems. And I think it ties in as well to and maybe helped produce the beat penchant for traveling, for the road as a place of mystique, the Lone Rider. On the road is Kerouac always arriving in a new town, setting the story in motion, and then on and on and on. I mean, it goes back way beyond to Odysseus and that kind of thing. So it's hardly a solely American phenomenon, but I think it was maybe dramatized, popularized, and thrown into our faces by the power of American media. So you're left with it. And what can one say about Clint Eastwood?
Kerouac as a High Plains drifter.
Yes. Well, he references, as far as I can remember, various sort of cowboy images, Wild West images in the book. He refers to one character as, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's about being a high plains guy who's drifting in from nowhere. And it all sort of ties in a weird way. I mean, it's a sort of mythology that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be relevant to the Beats, but I think it is in many ways.
Yeah, I think you're right. The Headless Palms of Desert Center is a piece that says so much about what you experienced. Can you read that?
Yep, I can. Yeah. Well, I'll talk about it afterwards, maybe just read it first. This is called The Headless Palms of Desert Center. There used to be a chorus line of palms, a brief mirage of glamour along I-10. Then the palms were beheaded. So Desert Center's centerpiece is a chorus line of black stumps. They mark the site of an exodus. Ditto the abandoned school and store, the unintended sculpture park of scrapyard machines. A message from the grave on the gas station. Enjoy your drive. Count the sites like these in the West. Deserted truck stops, trailers, cafes, shacks, and motels. Sizable towns abandoned. Realite had a train station, a newspaper, a bank, saloons, and diners. The gold mine closed, and the town did too. Use it up and leave. Always another promise. Pioneers set the tone. They left homes, families, friends, and before the journey west was over, many had left almost everything else as well. In their wake, a trail of discards, clothing, furniture, tools, livestock, even the wagons they rode in. Among the discarded items found in the traveling season of 48 were these: a boy and his sister, parents dead, oxen dead, and no more food. The boy was sick with cholera. The girl was nursing him. Destitute orphans without transport, one diseased and the other a girl, were a burden. The wagon train laid that burden down.
Use it up and leave, always another promise.
Yes, I'm fascinated by the transitoriness of a great deal of the American West, the civilized human part of it, and by the fragility of the human presence and how it's so dependent on a landscape which can be nourishing, but in the way that it's being occupied, becomes essentially hostile. And this is just one example of it. And the same phenomenon of places simply abandoned doesn't happen in Europe as a whole, or particularly in the UK. The sort of low-grade equivalent of a gold mine, coal mines, the whole of the South Wales coal field was effectively closed down. It was at one time the source, the main source of coal for the whole world, and now it produces none. And the dramatic impact that that's had on communities is a whole story in itself. But the communities themselves weren't abandoned. They may have been emotionally and financially abandoned by the governments of the day, but the people stayed, and the idea was, no, we're not going to ask the people to leave. We're going to find ways of bringing new industry to them. And that has been done with, I suppose, mixed success. I come from a place called Cwmbran in South Wales, which, because of its location, has managed, or partly because of that, has managed to reinvent itself. But the idea that the other places would just be abandoned and you'd move somewhere else. No. So, I mean, that's that so many things, as you and other Americans would find about Britain, so I find about America, that not unfathomable, but alien, truly alien.
The poet Gary Snyder is one of the early bioregionalists who believe that our first commitment should not be a country necessarily, but a bioregion or a watershed, certainly. So being more deeply connected to place, because he said that U.S. Americans live on the land as invaders. And what you're pointing out in your book is very graphic illustration of that.
Yes. There's another poem that mentions in passing the pioneers, and I'm sort of fascinated by the idea of the pioneers. I discovered, for instance, I think this is right, that most or many of them were well off, because, well, comparatively well off, because you needed money to buy a wagon, to have beasts to pull it, to have cattle with you that could act as food and maybe provide milk on the way, to have all the clothing, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't something where, you know, some bum off the street could say, well, I tell you what, I think I'm off to California. It's, what, 3,000 miles from the East Coast, and you're not going to be able to walk it without any money. So their idea was what? To make more money, or to make it in a better climate, or whatever. It wasn't, it's sort of sometimes painted as if it was a kind of moral crusade, but people saw money, and what they were prepared to do to get to that money was absolutely incredible. The hardships, I found it unbelievable, some of the stories of how people got over the Sierras, for instance, pulling wagons up with ropes. Just incredible.
Sometimes not making it through the Sierras.
Oh, yes, quite. Yeah, I mentioned the same thing, the Donner Party, which is not well known over here, but presumably is a lot better known in the States, who took what they thought was going to be a shortcut. And the whole thing of getting across in the season, as it were, was to get across the Sierras before the first snow came. And because their shortcut was actually the long way round, they didn't make that. And some of them were accused of or found to have eaten the flesh of others of them that had died. So it's a fascinating and quite gruesome story, but immense, whatever else, immense bravery and resourcefulness.
The very next piece in the book is The Revolution Begins in Palm Springs.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that would be a good piece to read.
Yeah, this is about the, I've already mentioned, the conflict, the dualism between the civilizations that have populated much of the West and the landscape that they've tried to subdue rather than live within. So yeah, the revolution begins in Palm Springs. Walked from a bar in Park Springs, looking down, checking the phone, and then look up. A couple of hundred yards ahead is a hunk of red raw mountain. Wilderness at the end of the street. Only a dog walk away. Once I drove into Death Valley and the car engine died. In the minutes to resurrection, the desert stopped being scenery, came creeping, knife between its teeth, to open the door. Las Vegas gave the desert its due. The god Mojave is a jealous god, a vengeful, unforgiving god. That deserves respect. Casinos were named as offerings. Sands, the Mirage, the Desert Inn, the Dunes. Then came Bellagio, Venetian, Palazzo, Paris, and all the rest. Las Vegas no longer acknowledged the desert. Too much like looking at its own grave. This is not an unreal city, says lofty Las Vegas. It's the desert that's a mirage. In Palm Springs, among the resorts, an acre of scrubland. I'd normally see an absence. Today it's a vivid, avenging presence, ready to arise, reclaim. First, it will make guerrilla raids on small businesses nearby. Bob's Pizza, for starters. And from that base, it can overrun the Renaissance, the Hilton, the Hard Rock Hotel. Soon the whole town will succumb. Pretty palms shriveling. Sprinkler jets no longer hissing. Swimming pools forever cracked and dry. The hunk of mountain and the scrubland made one. Phoenix will be next. Then hubristic Vegas. Even from this distance, the call of coyotes in the Hollywood Hills is clear.
Now, you wrote that a couple of years ago, and yet this summer, the summer of 2023, we have this heat dome situated basically over that area. I know Phoenix has been hit with some kind of 3 weeks with over 110 degree temperatures, low temperatures of 90 degrees. Can you imagine the low temperature, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 weeks in a row in Seattle? When it gets over 78, we start complaining. So you can imagine.
Yeah.
It seems to me there's a prophetic feel. When I hear you read those words about the town will succumb, pretty palms shriveling, sprinkler jets no longer hissing, swimming pools forever cracked and dry. That time might be sooner than we know, considering the realities of the Anthropocene, no?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a very conflicted attitude to these places. I love Palm Springs. I love Las Vegas. I think Las Vegas is brilliant. But you're very conscious of the fact they've basically been, particularly Las Vegas, plopped down in the middle of wilderness. It's the sort of phenomenon that you don't get on this island, which is very domesticated in the appearance of the landscape, so that you get a gradation from town or city to suburb to farmland, and the few places that are truly, or at least apparently, wild are all at a safe distance. But even a place like Los Angeles, it's built in a desert. There's a mountain range within the city. There's the Santa Monica Mountains, the Hollywood Hills. So it's the sort of juxtaposition that we're simply not used to. I spent 3 weeks or so on business in Pittsburgh and was astonished to find that it appeared to be built in a forest. and that occasionally we'd have deer coming up to the office window. And this was Pittsburgh, which I assumed in my head was like some sort of vision of hell, with the steelwork furnaces and molten iron all over the place. But no, I mean, there were very, very few places. New York is maybe one of them, where the city seems to have been camped down on the land and said, right, you know, this is my place, it's not your place. There's no sense of that in the West. I remember from the hotel window in Tacoma, when I was at your poetry festival, Tacoma's a, I know, middling sort of place, town, from the window of the hotel, you could see, I think it was Rainier, Mount Rainier, and it was really clear and really big and white. And you just couldn't avoid being drawn to it all the time. So that kind of wild, untamed nature is omnipresent in the West in a way that it isn't certainly in the UK.
Yes,
so the whole thing is dramatized, as it were, civilization, the natural landscape. It's dramatized by the extremes on either side.
Right. Talk to us about your process. Did you keep a journal? Did you write poems along the way, or did you gather material and then write later in the comfort of your studio?
I made notes. Some things I recollected, but I'm the sort of person who, if he isn't trying to pay attention, can be not very observant. So I was making a point of taking note of things. But actually, it's easier when you're in a place that is so utterly different from your own experience. There's a poem about that. Could I read that if I can?
Absolutely.
Yeah. The first part of the road trip I made was from SeaTac to Pendleton in eastern Washington, I think.
Pendleton, Oregon.
Oregon, right. And I only stopped there because it was the last place before dark, really. I thought, I've got to stop somewhere, so I stopped there. No, I tell a lie, it wasn't Pendleton, it was Jackpot. Got it, right. So this is the one about the defamiliarization of the effect of being in a different environment. The next stop after Pendleton was a place called Jackpot, which is just over the Idaho border in Nevada. It only exists, as far as I can see, because it can draw people from Idaho to casinos. So it's just a couple of casinos and, you know, a few convenience places, and that's it, in the middle of nowhere. So anyway, this is called Buying Beer with Rene Magritte. Route 93 has traveled 1,000 miles to reach this stoplight. I'm crossing it to buy some beer. 6 bottles of Lagunitas from a general store called General Store. A trivial act, but it resonates. The High Sierra of shopping trips. The Grand Canyon of beer buying. Same when I walk to the Nosh Cafe, and when I'm eating the pizza I've bought, and opening one of the beers. The American West is a sky for making strange. My actions are men suspended there, in suits and bowler hats. There's you'll be familiar with it, the painting by Magritte, just that, men dressed for office work from the early 20th century, just hanging in the... I've seen it actually in when I was in Brussels for the Beat conference you attended.
That's where we met, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also went to the Magritte Museum, and Magritte is a companion in this book. He shows up, I think, at least 3 times.
Yeah, because it struck me that was the essence of one aspect of the experience of the journey, which was that simple things that I'd normally think nothing of, wouldn't remember, wouldn't make a note of, seemed to attain amazing significance. And it was not because they were significant in themselves. It was about the unfamiliar context in which they were placed, just as these figures in the Magritte painting are only striking because of the unfamiliar context in which they appear.
I'm reminded of that Magritte piece. You look at it, and it looks like a house in the daytime, but then you look up, and there's the night sky in it.
Yes.
So one has to look carefully and look again.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's at the core of what your experience was in this road trip. One of the other things that strikes me, and of course, you write a book and present a paper on Richard Brautigan. We've mentioned Jack Kerouac. You have a bit of McClure in the book. You mentioned Snyder in the book. So there's very much a Beat influence about this. Can you talk about how they've influenced you and what you take from them? And
yes, I suppose I'd mostly, well, to go back, when I was young, like a lot of people at the time, I found the Beat, or what we took to be the Beat notion of the world, found it very appealing. It was a sort of outlaw image against the status quo. Your parents wouldn't like them. So they were sort of a literary, philosophical equivalent of Elvis Presley or Jerry Lee Lewis. So there was that appeal. There are always books when you're growing up that you have to read. So you have to get On the Road, you have to get Howl, which I could make no sense of at all at the time, I seem to remember. And then I sort of dropped it, I think. And then when I was in my 50s and I went back to university and did a PhD on Brautigan, I had to read all these people all over again and all about the San Francisco scene that developed from them and how they began in New York. But that really San Francisco became much more accepted, acknowledged around the world as a Beat center. And I was attracted again. I've never really enjoyed Ginsberg's poetry that much. I think I appreciated On the Road more than I did first time around. I read a lot more of Gary Snyder than I had before, and he's a big favorite. So yes, I learned a lot more about them and grew to like quite a few. Jack Spicer, I like. And he's hardly Beat. In fact, he was vehemently anti-Beat, although Beat is such a vague concept in itself that really it's difficult to know who to exclude or who to include. But yeah, it was quite an experience going back over that stuff. And what I'd always kept from the first time around with reading Beat stuff, particularly On the Road, was this mystique of the road thing. I'd always kept that, and that was rekindled again. There's actually a poem, if I could.
Absolutely.
Read it, which speaks to it. It's called To Whom It May Concern. I'm viewing the open coffin of the Beats, aka North Beach. Always the same routine. Canolo, espresso at the Cafe Greco. Drinks at Tosca, Specs or Vesuvio, Trieste or Mario's, read and browse at City Lights, t-shirt, then leave with a book and a t-shirt, visit a statue I know from the cover of Trout Fishing in America. Give or take, it's a standard boho dance. On the Road gave gospel fever when I was in my teens. Only the road could give me a hipster soul. The mystique of the road remains. But Sal and Dean are gods no more. They're as flaky as I am. Ditto most of the Beats. The puzzling thing is this. I come here time and again. Maybe it's like Christmas. I don't believe in Santa or Christ, but the memory of when I did has stayed and preserves a sense of wonder. Maybe the key is City Lights, where a little faith, however tainted, isn't hard to find. This is the Boho Beach Cathedral. This is Belief Central. There should be Gothic arches, grand expanses of stained glass, Ferlinghetti dispensing blessings and candles of prayer. I would light a candle. I do it in every cathedral, in memory, in wishfulness, to whom it may concern.
Yes, I suppose that articulates it very well. Are you flaky, John Tanner?
Oh, yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah. It seems to be part of the human condition. Well, that's my excuse anyway.
Well, if you're in Wales and you do a PhD on Richard Brautigan, I'm sure that many around you probably have made that conclusion that you're flaky. Did you get grief for that PhD dissertation?
Well, I sort of, not so much grief, more bewilderment, because I mean, the way it happened was that, I mean, I'd read trout fishing in America when I was young. Again, one of the things that crop up and you've got to read it. And I can't remember what impression it made, but it can't have been a great one because I didn't read anything else by Brautigan and I couldn't remember anything about the book. And I was traveling in the States and I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, and there was a secondhand bookshop there. I think it was called the Starlight Bookshop. And I'm sure that, like yourself, I can't not go into a secondhand bookshop. And so I did. And I saw Trout Fishing in America there and I thought, I'll give that another try. I took it to the counter. And the guy said, you know, he said, this isn't about trout fishing. I mean, it is in various ways, but I suppose he thought I might be an actual, you know, fishing aficionado. And he didn't want me to be disappointed and find that there were no tips and so on. So anyway, I read it again and I thought, this is absolutely great. There were so many things I liked about it. And I thought that it was at the time when I was just trying to think of what I'd do for a PhD. And I thought, I read how he'd been a late 60s icon, early 70s youth icon. And then it virtually disappeared and then killed himself. And there was nothing much written about him. So there were two appeals about that. One was you could do something that might go some small way towards helping to rekindle interest. And also, nobody much had written about him. So instead of plow through 600 volumes of secondary reading, I mean, it turned out to be a lot more reading than I expected because, of course, there's all the context and you had to read the books written by all the people who were part of the context and know a good bit about their biographies. So by the time I finished, it was a lot harder than I'd expected. But yeah, mostly bafflement from people. Very few people that had heard of him.
Yeah.
And it's a great shame. Great shame.
You say in that piece, and preserves a sense of wonder. Is that what your connection to Beats and Black Mountain and San Francisco Renaissance and these writers, a sense of wonder? Do you think that's at the core of your attraction?
I think at the time that I was attracted to the Beats as a young person, I was looking, as many young people do, for causes, for certainty, for something to believe in. And the more you look into these things that you try to embrace, the more you find that there are flaws, and there have to be flaws. Once you've built people up to be this amazing edifice that you want to bow down to, you're bound to find that there's something wrong with it. I hope what the poem's about is trying to come to an adult, sensible adult acceptance that actually the fact that these people were as flaky as I am is neither here nor there. they were trying something, and it was something different, and it was something that had, apart from all the flaky bits, a lot of nobility to it. And that's worth something. And the fact that it's not perfect, so what? Nothing is. But it was a good try. And I think the influence of the Beats through the hippies and through subsequent generations has been a lot greater than has been acknowledged. And the influence is there within causes and within people who maybe aren't familiar at all with the Beats. But these messages have been carried forward. The messages, for the most part, weren't original, but they were a means by which they were popularized for a while and then became circulated and then carried forward into the next generation.
Interesting how you latched on to Brodigan, who's really the link between the Beats and the hippies. He's probably the main bridge.
Yeah.
To be able to see ourselves through the eyes of the other is quite a gift. But as you're well aware, U.S. Americans are rarely interested in self-knowledge or introspection. Do you agree with that statement about having this view of ourselves from someone outside of us? And was that what you hoped to accomplish with the book, or why? Why'd you write the book? And what do you hope that having done this book accomplishes?
I love America. I also find a lot of things that have happened and are happening in America truly appalling. I mean, the fact that Donald Trump can emerge as not only a credible candidate, but as a president. And there are some parallels in the UK, but nothing that extreme. Anyone with his backstory would never have made it onto a ballot sheet, much less made it to the presidency. But I think there is something wonderful and restorative about America, that the best America. And I like the way that in some of the American writing that I'm most attracted to, something like, say, Philip Roth's American Pastoral, in some songs, like a couple of Paul Simon songs, that they can look at aspects of America in their time and say, no, this isn't for me. But that is not for them a criticism of America. It is an American. And I think that's something that comes through in a lot of Beat writing. Kerouac was a great patriot and unfortunately had in later life, some quite right-wing views. But the critiques of America, and from Ginsberg the same, the critiques of America are always from inside and in sorrow as a betrayal of the ideals that they associate with America. There's a sense, I think, in which 50s and 60s bohemians saw themselves as the true America, and what was around them, calling them outsiders and un-American. They were the ones who were the true outsiders. Easy Rider is a similar thing, where Captain America goes off on his motorbike and he's rejected everywhere he goes. And yet he would have seen himself as a representative of the true spirit of adventure and more perhaps kindly qualities that he thought were truly American and were being betrayed by the communities that they went through.
He's not in right now. Might be a good piece to end with, do you think?
He's not in right. Oh, right. Yes. I suppose you need to have some familiarity with Richard Brautigan to make much sense of this, but
Richard who?
Yeah,
as you say in the piece. Yeah.
So this is about Richard Brautigan, late 1960s. Well, he'd been writing, publishing since the 50s, but late 1960s phenomenon. San Francisco-based writer went out of favor with the hippies, essentially, when they started to be laughed at, and deserves better. Anyway, he's not in right now. I'm off again, following old Papa, old Hemingway. I think I'll call it Death by Illusion, I tell him. Just play it straight for once, says testy Papa. He doesn't like me dressing up his prose in a jester's clothes. Of course, you don't have a clue about that. You haven't even read me, have you? I'm unknown again. I liked it better the first time, the young, hungry, hopeful time. So let me give you a taste of my stuff, concentrated, for a fuller flavor. Jump in my haiku ambulance and we'll fuck like fried potatoes, then drive off to the octopus frontier, where the crabs all eat like cigars, and even Kafka's Sunday hat must have its own bowl of reasons. My reasons are clouds. Exhibit 1. Unique. He presents the world as if seen for the first time. Exhibit 2. A trivial vision, sugar-baked in whimsy. Exhibit 3. Richard who? A career in a brief stanza, my friends. Anyway, I talk some more, but oh, that papa, he says no. Oh, that papa, he says time for the pale marble movie. Scene 1, it's hand to gun. Scene 2, it's gun to head. Scene 3, a flashback. I'm busy performing a double haiku, a final misdirection. This is the recorded voice of Richard Brautigan. He's not in right now. Leave a message when you hear the beep, and I may return your call. So he emulated Hemingway by killing himself with a shot to the head. He was 49, and the voicemail message is in William Hertzberg's biography of Brautigan, Jubilee Hitchhiker, which I recommend. Oh, his daughter. Doesn't I seem to remember.
Did she say something to the effect that he could have left some stuff out?
Yes, and also she disagreed with some of the conclusions and facts, and yeah, well, that's the way it is, isn't it?
I believe the video of the panel is online for people who want to look to it.
It is. I discovered it.
As I recall.
Yeah.
Well, for a person who I casually meet at a conference in Brussels to show up in Tacoma, to then take a road trip, to then write this book, How to Make an America, and then to be here and reading your work so beautifully, reading your beautiful, your beautiful work, which does have that appreciation for a sense of wonder. And it's a really beautiful moment for me, John. So thank you for taking the time to be here today, for doing what you've done. And I hope that we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Very kind of you. Thank you.
John Tanner is the author of How to Make an America. It's available as an ebook through Kindle and other places where you get such digital books. Cascadian Profit supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprofits.org.
Cascadian Profits is a project of the Cascadia Poetics Lab in Seattle, Washington. Check us out online at cascadiapoeticslab.org.